Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. We've all heard plenty about the Zika virus by now, but it's hard to know. How worried should I be? What are my chances of getting Zika? Should I put off travel plans? Donald G. McNeil Jr. is a science reporter who covers disease for the New York Times, and he attempts to answer many of those questions in his new book, Zika, The Emerging Epidemic. Donald G. McNeil Jr., welcome to The Roundtable.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
You write that the Zika virus has been around really since the 1940s. When did you first become aware of it?
Well, I heard about it fairly recently, but not quite as a little earlier than everybody else. I had a phone call from a PR person for the University of Texas Medical School in September, and he said, you know, we've got a doctor here who'd like to talk to you about a new virus that's come to America. It's called Zika, and I thought, that's an interesting name. Now, remember, this is September, so I did talk to the doctor, a guy named Scott Weaver, for about half an hour, and he was describing this disease, but he said it was basically considered a mild disease, except that in rare cases it had caused Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a kind of creeping paralysis that starts in your hands and feet and goes towards your chest, but that most people recover from. But he said it was worrisome. There are a number of diseases that might come to the Americas from other countries. And he sent me a paper he'd written in 2009, and Zika was mentioned in it, but it was sort of one of the also-rans. It was the two he worried most about were Rift Valley fever and Japanese encephalitis. And so I thanked him for the conversation, and I had taken my notes, and I made sure I could read them, and then I stapled them and stuck them into my head-scratcher pile, as this is kind of an interesting thing that I might want to write about someday. Mm-hmm. And I went back to whatever story I was working on then. And then it was the week after Christmas, and things were really quiet here at the paper, and I write a weekly global health item. It's not really a column. It's a very short thing, and I was looking for something to write about that week, and scanning websites having to do with diseases, and I saw a story out of Brazil saying that there was a wave of babies born with tiny heads in Brazil, and that one of the members of the health ministry had asked women to stop having children if they could. And I just practically jumped out of my chair going, what? I've never heard of any government asking women to stop having children, because, taken to extremes, that's the end of the country. No more kids, no more Brazil. There's China's one-child policy, but that was economic, and that was one child. It was different. So I called the one doctor I knew in Brazil and said, is this for real? And, what caused it? And he said, yes, it's for real, and it's terrifying. These babies are being born. And he said, their lives are ruined. Their parents' lives are ruined. These are kids who are never going to be able to walk or talk or speak. They're basically, some of them are going to die early, and some of them are just going to, lie there. They will never be able to move, may not be able to control their bowels, will have all sorts of physical problems. And he said, we don't know what it is. We know there was this disease that went through about 9 months ago. It was a mild disease. We don't know if women have been infected with dengue, which was also here, and then got this disease, or if it's all, the disease all by itself. He said, it's a big mess. And he said also, the Olympics are going to happen. We've had this really bad El Nino year. The mosquitoes are still around. The Olympics is going to be a mess. So that made me write about it instantly that afternoon, and Brazil had just declared a state of emergency, so our Rio bureau chief canceled his vacation, his Christmas vacation, and he came and he wrote a front-page story the day after that. So he and I have been working on it together basically ever since.
You have written that the summer would be key to Zika in the States, in North America. Why is the summer seen as so important?
Well, the virus has moved very rapidly out of northeast Brazil and has moved virtually every place else in the Western Hemisphere where there are Aedes aegypti mosquitoes. It's in Mexico. It's in Puerto Rico, which is part of the United States. It's in every island in the Caribbean. It's all the way down South America, all the way to northern Chile and Argentina, where it begins to get cold again. So basically, Florida's next. Texas is next. The Gulf Coast is next. Parts of Hawaii may be next. We know that there are Aedes aegypti mosquitoes there. Those are the same mosquitoes that carried dengue and chikungunya, and we've had small outbreaks of dengue and chikungunya in Florida and Texas. Also, nobody has any immunity to this disease. They're what's called immunologically naive, and the great example of immunological naivete is the American Indians when white people arrived here. In the 1400s, the white people brought measles and smallpox and a dozen other diseases, and 90% of the Indians were wiped out ultimately because they had no protection against any of these diseases. So, I mean, this is not that. Zika is not fatal. It's not even dangerous except to newborn, to unborn children. But we are naive. We have no protection. We have no antibodies. So for those who live in the areas where the mosquitoes are rampant, there's the possibility of an epidemic.
You mentioned, of course, that it's incredibly dangerous for women who are having children or attempting to have children. But what about the rest of the population? What happens if you are bitten by one of these mosquitoes?
It's not, for the rest of the population, it's not that big a deal. You know, it's a mosquito-borne disease, but it's not malaria. It's not yellow fever. It's not dengue. You know, those can all kill. This one, 80% of people have no symptoms. For the 20% that do have symptoms, it's usually they get a low fever, you know, 102, 103 at most. They get a rash on their body. It's a kind of looks like a hives rash. It's not like a chickenpox rash where you have pustules. It's more like red raised, bumpy rash. Get bloodshot eyes, conjunctivitis, headache, aches and pains, swollen joints. So it's not fun, but it's not the end of the world. Almost nobody's ever hospitalized from it. There is one rare side effect. It's called Guillain-Barré syndrome, which we live with some risk of Guillain-Barré at all times. I mean, you can get Guillain-Barré after a bad cold, after a stomach virus. You can get it from eating undercooked chicken. You can get it from as a side effect or a reaction to surgery sometimes. And Guillain-Barré can be really scary. You know, there are a few people who die from it because the paralysis creeps in all the way to their diaphragm and their chest muscles, and they can't breathe. But for most people, it's a kind of paralysis that comes on. It can last for months. It's not necessarily total paralysis. I know a guy who had it who just got it in his hands and feet, and he couldn't type, and he had some trouble walking for a while, but then it went away. From Zika appears to raise the risk. If your normal risk is about 1 in 100,000 per year, it raises it to about 1 in 4,000. So that's increasing the risk by 25 times, but it's still a rare risk. And we live with 1 in 4,000 risks all the time. You know, I mean, you live with a worse than 1 in 4,000 risk of getting hit by a car in your lifetime, for example. And yet we all drive and cross streets.
Let me ask you about something you said earlier about the fact that the Zika has spread so far and wide. How is that happening? It's not like the mosquitoes can fly thousands of miles. How is this spread taking place?
The mosquitoes don't have to fly thousands of miles because people will do it for them. Somebody gets the virus in their blood from being bitten by a mosquito, and they get on an airplane. The virus stays in their blood for about 10 days. They get off the airplane, and there's some place where another mosquito is waiting to bite them and carry the virus on to somebody else. So that's the way most diseases transmit it. Mosquitoes are lucky if they make it a mile in their lifetime. I mean, once in a while, a mosquito in Africa will get onto a plane and take a vacation in France and, you know, fly off and bite somebody. And there is a phenomenon called airport malaria. Near Charles de Gaulle Airport in France, you get 2 or 3 cases of malaria every year. And that's why when planes leave Africa, one of the things they do is the flight attendants walk down the aisle spraying insecticide. People get all upset about it, but the idea is to protect them from malaria. So that's rare. That's not how the disease is transmitted. The disease is transmitted by people taking it to areas where the right mosquitoes are flying around and biting. And the parts of this country where those mosquitoes are is basically Florida, the Gulf Coast, southern Texas. I mean, up in Albany, there is not much risk. It's true that mosquitoes, that Aedes aegypti mosquitoes have been found as far north as New York State in the past, but it's rare and it's small numbers and it's at the end of long, hot summers. So there's a possibility, but the risk is not very high outside of the Deep South and Hawaii and a couple other tropical places.
Isn't it also the case that there's a very good chance you might have it without knowing it?
Yes. 80% chance if you've got it. I mean, I'm going to Puerto Rico next week, and I might get it. And if I get it, there's a 4 out of 5 chance I won't even know I have it. And then there's a 1 out of 5 chance I might, I'll get the symptoms that I described. Now, I'm not pregnant, and I'm not trying to get anybody pregnant, so I'm not a serious risky vector, even if I get sick. But, anywhere in the United States, you know, tropical or non-tropical, even in northern Greenland, if a guy comes back with the disease, he can possibly pass it on. And the danger is, you know, and the warnings from the CDC and the WHO is, you know, if you are with someone who is pregnant or is trying to get pregnant, you need to not have unprotected sex. You know, no unprotected sex for the length of the pregnancy. They suggest before, you know, if the wife or girlfriend is pregnant, and if they're trying to get pregnant, they should wait 6 months, basically, because the virus has been known to break into men's testicles and live in their semen for up to 2 months. And the CDC's way of being cautious about things is it takes the longest known period that a bad thing can happen, and then it triples it to make sure. So they know it can last for 2 months because there have been two cases that have been found. So they say, wait 6 months to be sure that you don't have the virus in your semen.
Now, there's no vaccine for Zika. As we speak, Congress has left for the summer, and there's somewhat of a big fight where many of the Democrats are pushing for an increase in spending on studying Zika. How close are scientists to, you know, creating a vaccine for Zika?
You know, the Congress did not pass a bill before it went into recess. That's a problem, but it won't stop the beginning stages of making vaccines. There are about 18 different vaccine candidates being worked on by various companies and research institutes. The NIH, the National Institutes of Health, is working on three, and one of them might be ready as early as September for safety testing. Tony Fauci, who's the head of the Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases, says. But that safety testing is going to take 2 years, and there's really no way around it. 2 years is the best-case scenario, and it's because you cannot make a mistake with a vaccine. You know, when somebody's dying of cancer, you know, you can try out any kind of wild, dangerous, toxic drug on them because they're going to die otherwise. But vaccines are put into healthy people, and ultimately the target for these vaccines is pregnant women or women who are about to get pregnant, and they're the most vulnerable members. They and their babies are the most vulnerable members of society. So you have to make sure that a vaccine is absolutely dead sure it is safe, and you have to make sure it works. Interestingly, in some ways, the best vaccine for Zika is to go out and get bitten, as long as you're not pregnant and not going to get pregnant during the first 2 weeks after you've been bitten. So it would not be a terrible thing, you know, for girls who are not pregnant. It would actually be a good thing to get Zika and recover from it, since it's a mild disease, since 80% of the people don't even have symptoms, and since you are then safe. We don't know how long the immunity is, you know, in the same way that, you know, you have chickenpox once, you don't get chickenpox again. You have smallpox once, if you survive, you don't get smallpox again. Measles the same way. This disease seems to be similar. It seems to be something you get once, and then you have antibodies and you're immune. We don't know if it's lifetime immunity because we've only studied it for less than a year, but it looks like long-lasting immunity. So presumably, if a girl gets infected, she can recover and then go on to have healthy babies later.
So the hypothesis is then that over the years, this should tend to taper off a bit then.
Correct. Yeah. In fact, there was a study that was just released today doing mathematical modeling of the epidemic in Latin America, particularly in South America. And it says, you know, this should die out completely within 2 or 3 years. And then when it comes back, this is even if nobody invents a vaccine, and I'm confident a vaccine will be invented, but even if nobody invented one, the disease would probably disappear for 10 years at a time, because what you'd have is a population where, you know, maybe 90% of the population would be immune. And so even if somebody came back with the virus, the mosquitoes would pick it up from them, but then they couldn't pass it on to anybody else because they'd have immunity. So you have to wait for a whole new generation of kids to be born before you have enough kids who are not immune to sustain an epidemic, so that mosquitoes would be able to bite basically children and pass the disease back and forth. That's the way diseases used to work in the old days before vaccines. I mean, measles would come along. It wasn't like there was always measles present in New York City or anyplace else. It was more like there'd be an outbreak and almost everybody would get infected. And then you'd have 10 or 20 years where there wouldn't be any measles around, and then somebody new would come back with measles, and, you know, parents wouldn't get infected because they had immunity, but the kids would get infected. So, and that's why these became childhood diseases. It's not that children are the only ones that are susceptible. It's usually the children of the generation that hasn't had it before. So diseases tend to go back and forth among young people.
Now, that might be good news for people who aren't, you know, building a family. You did allude to this earlier in the interview, though. There's going to be a generation of children born with microcephaly. And, you know, what are their prospects? And, you know, what kind of challenge does that pose?
Their prospects are miserable. I mean, some of them are going to die in the first week of life. And some of them are never going to walk, never going to talk. Some of them are going to be blind and deaf. Some with extremely mild cases may be okay. They may have emotional problems. They may have learning problems. There's a theory, and I've written about this, that even children who are born apparently healthy may have a higher rate of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder later in life. There's a fair amount of evidence that when you injure a baby in the womb, while its brain is growing, you have consequences. It may not be obvious. There may not be obvious emotional or learning disabilities early in life, but then there are higher rates of schizophrenia among babies born towards the end of the flu season each year, among the generation of babies born right after the 1957 flu, the Asian flu. There are other viruses that do do similar brain damage and are thought to lead to higher rates of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder later in life. So it's quite scary prospects. I mean, this is something where nobody should worry about it if they're not pregnant. But if they're pregnant, they should worry a lot. And if they're thinking about getting pregnant, this is not a good time to think about getting pregnant if you're in an area where Zika is likely to be transmitted. But that's more of a worry for Florida than it is for upstate New York.
Just one more question. You've covered so many diseases and epidemics over the years. How do you put Zika into context with some of the other ones that have dominated our headlines?
Well, you have to sort of look at the number of people who die. I mean, that's a crude, you know, mean way of judging a disease, but you know, 1.5 million people around the world are going to die of tuberculosis this year. More than 1 million people are going to die of AIDS this year. About 500,000 kids are going to die of malaria this year. 90 people are going to die in the United States of traffic accidents today, and again tomorrow, and the day after that. So, in that context, Zika isn't that scary. You know, worry less about Zika and more about putting on your seatbelt. On the other hand, it's a new disease. So you need to think about it. Ebola is a disease that is terrifying because we've seen The Hot Zone or movies based on it, and it's a disease that causes this particularly horrible kind of death, you know, hemorrhagic fever. But, you know, the outbreak in West Africa was controlled a huge effort, but it was controlled by doing sensible things like, you know, stopping people from handling dead bodies and basically giving good nursing care to the sick without the infection being passed on. When there were cases of Ebola came to the United States, we handled them. There was only one case where one victim transmitted it to two nurses, and that's because the hospital had not given them good enough protective gear, and they'd gotten bad advice from the CDC about protective gear. But other than that, everybody who came back from overseas with Ebola didn't pass it on to anybody, and all but one of them recovered, didn't die. So diseases can be handled. I mean, you know, you need vaccines, you need good nursing care, you need mosquito control, depending on the disease. But, you know, it's very important that the countries stay alert. It's important that they spend enough money to be ready to handle these things, you know. I mean, we've had, you know, trillions spent on missiles for a war that never came. We don't spend nearly enough money worrying about diseases that, you know, year after year do get to this country.
Donald G. McNeil Jr. is a science reporter for The New York Times. His new book is called Zika, The Emerging Epidemic. Donald, thank you so much for your time and for your reporting.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
I'm Ian Pickus, and you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.